Thank you. Thank you all for coming. It's good to be back to the Bay Area. The one problem with getting a PhD from a place usually is that they don't hire you afterwards as a professor. So you're sort of like Moses, knowing that when you get to the promised land, you can't go inside the walls. So it's good occasionally to visit and know that you can be back. So this book is a little personal for me in the sense of one of the reasons I got a PhD in political science was that I sort of naively believed that part of what you could do would be to influence the marketplace of ideas, that as a political scientist, I could write things in a variety of venues and people would read them, and who knows, maybe policy would actually get changed. And to be fair, that's not entirely unrealistic, or I wasn't, you know, I didn't think it was necessarily naive. John Maynard Keynes, in one of his great masterworks, you know, wrote very famously, "The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influence are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority, who hear voices in the air, are distilling the frenzy from some academic scribbler of a few years back." So if Keynes thinks that ideas matter, I'm not nearly as smart as he is, but I thought maybe that would, you know, potentially be the way in which you could actually have an impact on the world. And there is that kind of naive view that even if you write a sort of serious scholarly work, eventually some version of that idea will trickle down, you know, to the rest of the world, with the idea that therefore you can actually have a relatively appropriate conversation about the right way to, you know, advance democracy or secure the national interest or what have you. Of course, there is a valid question about whether or not the marketplace of ideas actually works terribly well. And indeed, part of the reason I wrote this book was that things have been happening over the last few years that suggest that maybe intellectuals don't necessarily, you know, the sort of way in which the marketplace of ideas functions isn't exactly the way we would want it to. So exhibit A would be the notion that you had, on the one hand, a president in Barack Obama who actually, I think, thought of himself as an intellectual. And yet once he became president, to some extent felt imprisoned by a category he referred to as the blob, which referred to the sort of collection of foreign policy intellectuals and think tankers and so on and so forth in Washington, D.C., who he felt constrained what he could do as president. And then on the other hand, you have Donald Trump. And you have to give Donald Trump credit. As a candidate, he managed to actually unify the opinions of people who studied foreign policy ranging from the far left to the far right, in which there was almost unanimity that this guy would be an unmitigated disaster as a foreign policy president. Various petitions were signed, various statements from historians or political scientists or economists or foreign policy experts, including a lot of Republican foreign policy experts, warning this was a bad idea. If anything, Trump as a candidate leaned into this, basically saying, you know, we need to shake the rust out of American foreign policy, and in some ways echoing Michael Gove, who was a British minister, who during the Brexit campaign, even though every sort of expert community warned that Brexit would not work out well for the British economy, Gove responded, "I welcome the fact that the experts on the other side. I think we need to listen to the people." And as a result, despite all of these sort of warnings, Donald Trump got elected president. I also have to deal personally with the fact, as David said, I've written 6 books, and this is the 6th one. And I'm proud of all my books, but I have to recognize that without question, the book that everyone will remember when I am long dead and gone is a book I wrote about zombies, which was a small textbook trying to explain what theories of international relations would predict would happen if, in fact, the dead started rising from the grave and tried to feast upon the living. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm really proud of that book. I worked hard on it. But it is telling that's the book that, like, captures the most amount of attention in the public sphere. It makes me feel a little bit guilty at times. But at the same time, and this sort of reflects a general tendency of debate among intellectuals, usually when intellectuals are talking about what does the marketplace of ideas look like, what's the sort of state of public discourse, they tend to be extremely pessimistic. And this is a trope that has gone on, you can argue, from the 1950s with and late 1960s with Richard Hofstadter and Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, and then in the 80s, Russell Jacoby and The Last Intellectuals. And you have a whole raft of books over the last few years that have basically suggested that the state of ideas is not what it used to be. And indeed, the only debate among intellectuals seems to be, when did things start to go downhill? For some people, it was the death of the New York intellectuals, that would write for Dissent or what have you in the 1950s. For others, it was the death of Bloomsbury, the group that actually Keynes, among others, was a part of in the United Kingdom during the interwar period. And then others just basically go back to the death of Socrates and argue that it's been downhill since then. And that said, I actually don't necessarily agree with that. In some ways, there's never been a better time to be an intellectual. There's a whole variety of conferences and venues in which people are perfectly willing to hear what I have to say. The fact that you all have me here is extremely comfortable, extremely comforting. But the degree of hostility among my colleagues about concepts like TED Talks, for example, is fascinating to me. I have my own criticism of that format as a way of expressing ideas. But I also think it's somewhat churlish of someone like me who is paid to talk to people to be upset that it turns out that there's a large category of people that want to listen to podcasts or watch 18-minute videos in which they are introduced to new ideas. So we're kind of in a weird situation. We know that something seems to be off in the marketplace of ideas, but on the other hand, I do wonder if people are potentially being overly pessimistic. So, one explanation for all of this is it's all social media's fault. That, the problem is that everyone is addicted to Twitter or Facebook or some Google product, which I can't name, that is at fault. And I don't think that's the case, because among other things, even sort of very stodgy public intellectuals are now on Twitter as well. It's not like they're neglecting these things. And indeed, in the researching the book, I thought this might be one of the causes, and I was struck by the degree to which, regardless of one's intellectual quality, they all do want to be on social media. They will all tweet about it. My explanation instead rests on the notion that there are two types of intellectuals that essentially contribute to the marketplace of ideas, particularly in the area of foreign policy, which is the area that I know the best about. And I call these two categories public intellectuals and thought leaders. Now, these are terms that are constantly used a lot and often mean different things to different people, so I'll be a little more exact in terms of what I'm talking about. Public intellectuals, in some ways, are Isaiah Berlin's foxes. So Isaiah Berlin wrote a great essay back in the 1930s called The Hedgehog and the Fox, where he said that there were two kinds of thinkers. The fox knows a little bit about a lot, and the hedgehog knows one big thing. So public intellectuals work like foxes. They know a little bit about a lot, and they essentially are critics. Public intellectuals excel at telling you everything that is wrong with everyone else's idea. And that's a good quality. That is a quality that you want. You want, if you're introduced to a new idea, you want to know, well, what do I think about this? And certainly, to some extent, you want to make, your own judgment, but you also want to hear from learned scholars, presumably, in terms of what they think about it. Thought leaders, on the other hand, are hedgehogs. Thought leaders have one big idea that they think can explain everything. If you throw any kind of policy problem at this person, they will somehow find a way to get it back to whatever their big idea is. So thought leaders are evangelists. Thought leaders desperately want to tell you exactly the way the world works. And to some extent, one of the ways they excel is by explaining the extant, arguments about this are wrong. I have a better idea. Now, to be very clear, I believe that a good functioning marketplace of ideas needs both of these kinds of thinkers. You need both public intellectuals and you need thought leaders. And if you have them in balance, it works relatively well. It means that someone will come up with a new kind of idea, and then you have thought leaders that will stress test it to within an inch of its life. So the bad ideas presumably eventually disappear, and the good ideas might actually persist, eventually become consensus, and indeed might trickle down either to the public or to key policymakers. The problem is with, you're in a situation where it's out of balance. If you have a marketplace of ideas where there are too many public intellectuals and not enough thought leaders, essentially the barriers to entry are too high. Critics are too powerful. Someone who tries to come up with a new idea easily gets shot down. And so as a result, the marketplace becomes sort of stagnant and ossified. It's just an oligopoly. It's very difficult to sort of crack this kind of marketplace, and that's potentially problematic. On the other hand, a marketplace in which thought leaders predominate and there aren't a lot of public intellectuals, the problem in this instance is that the barriers to exit are too high. In essence, you have a much more vibrant and potentially heterogeneous marketplace of ideas. The problem is that stupid ideas don't die. You operate in a world where essentially a thought leader can come up with an idea that might be seductive for a whole variety of reasons, but if critics aren't powerful enough, they can't kill it. And so as a result, bad ideas will persist and wind up potentially getting into the mainstream. So essentially, if I was writing this book back in, let's say, the 1960s, I would make the argument that the problem is that public intellectuals are too powerful and we need more thought leaders. But because I'm writing this in 2017, I'm essentially arguing the opposite, that in fact, there are three sort of major tectonic forces in the United States that have stacked the deck powerfully in favor of thought leaders and have undercut the sort of traditional sources of public intellectuals. So I'll explain what those three are. The first is the erosion of trust in authority and expertise. So this data comes from the Pew Research Center, but I could have, you know, ginned up data from Gallup or the General Social Survey or any kind of long-run survey stream, and they all show the same thing. With the exception of the United States military, Americans' trust in every major governmental and non-governmental institution has declined precipitously since the 1960s. Essentially, beginning with Vietnam and Watergate, it follows this exact same thing. It goes, and then it sort of, you know, ping-pongs for a little bit. After 9/11, there is a brief spike. Trust in institutions really goes up after 9/11, and since then, it's been really, really bad. And we are now at sort of ultra-low levels in almost all of these things. This includes, by the way, knowledge institutions. So the General Social Survey runs an annual, you know, question in terms of confidence in sort of knowledge-based institutions or institutions that generate knowledge, medicine or higher education or what have you, in the scientific community. In 1974, approximately 50% of Americans placed a high degree of trust in those institutions. By 2012, the average had fallen to 30% of Americans that had placed high trust in those institutions. So as a result, the problem is that essentially Americans don't trust the sort of, you know, traditional institutions that generate presumably knowledge or expertise. Now the effect of this on the marketplace of ideas is pretty clear, which is essentially those who, you know, sort of traditionally produce public intellectuals, which are primarily universities or think tanks or what have you, you know, very often used to have the ability to argue from authority, which is to say Harvard professor says thing X is bad, and readers would see that and think, oh, well, he's a professor at Harvard. We should totally listen to him. Even if he didn't necessarily know what he was talking about, by the way, just the fact that he was a Harvard professor. But we are now operating in a world where no one cares necessarily if you are a professor, a tenured professor at Harvard, or if you were a think tank fellow at Brookings, or if you were a MacArthur Genius Grant winner or a Nobel Prize winner. Those sort of appellations don't matter nearly as much. And so as a result, this has lowered the barriers to entry. Someone can make an argument as a thought leader even if they lack potentially the traditional accreditations. Even though, by the way, thought leaders might very well have these accreditations. I'm not trying to say that they're necessarily less well-educated. But it basically, by Americans distrusting sort of traditional sources of authority, it opens up the possibility for new thought leaders to enter the marketplace. The second trend that matters is the rise of political polarization. So this chart is from a traditional political science data set that scores basically how Republicans and Democrats in the House vote. And as you can see, the data on this is relatively incontrovertible, which is over the last, you know, 30 or 40 years or so, Democrats have shifted somewhat to the left and Republicans have shifted way, way, way to the right. But this is not just limited to the House of Representatives. The Pew Research Center shows data suggesting that essentially the number of extreme partisans, both extreme left Democrats and extreme right Republicans, have doubled basically between 1994 and 2014. Now there's some debate among political scientists about whether or not the rest of the country is also becoming more polarized. Some people argue that essentially, yes, this is the case, and indeed the data since 2000 suggests this is going on. But other political scientists argue it's not so much that people are becoming more extreme, it's what we would call partisan sorting, which is to say essentially traditional Southern Democrats have suddenly decided, oh, no, we're actually Republicans, whereas, let's say, traditional Rockefeller Republicans who live in the Northeast realize, no, we're actually Democrats. And so if those two categories switch parties, it makes it look like there's stronger polarization when really what's happening is people are finding their ideological home. The one thing you can say is that the political parties are becoming more ideologically homogenous in a way that was not true 40 years ago. And the real problem now is the effect this has on political elites in terms of how they view the other side. Essentially, you now have polling that essentially shows that an ever-increasing fraction of both Republicans and Democrats view the partisans on the other side as a threat to the country, you know, which they did not view in terms of survey evidence from like the 1960s or 1970s, and that they thought they were a threat to the nation's well-being. And indeed, we are now at the point where survey evidence also shows that extreme partisans on both sides don't want their children to marry outside of their ideological persuasion. So essentially what is happening is that partisanship is almost replaced religion or race or gender as sort of a person's principled notion of identity to some extent. And indeed, there was one survey paper that basically took that created fake resumes of people in which they could potentially put something in like someone was working for the Young Democrats or the Young Republicans in college or something, basically a way to sort of signal to the employer what their ideological predisposition was. And then they also, before they did this, surveyed those employers to find out what their own political predilections were. And what turned out is that people who scored as either very conservative or very liberal were more likely to discriminate on hires based on political partisanship than based on race or religion or sexual orientation. So in other words, partisanship is a powerful drug. Now, the reason this affects the marketplace of ideas is that essentially, if you were a public intellectual, almost by definition, you are going to have heterogeneous opinions. You are sometimes going to say something that says, hey, you know what, I think the left might be somewhat wrong on issues like public school choice. Or I think the right might be wrong on denying the existence of climate change and the need for, you know, US policy to address it. The problem here is that essentially political partisans on both sides want their own house intellectuals. They don't want to hear contrarian points of view. And so as a result, this basically rewards people who are perfectly willing to say things that essentially reinforce, you know, partisans' pre-existing worldviews. So someone like a Dinesh D'Souza on the right, for example, who can just say everything is Obama's fault, or Sean Hannity would be another example of this. And then the final trend that matters is the rise of wealth inequality. And again, the data on this is relatively incontrovertible. Over the last 30 to 40 years, life has been extremely good for the top 1% of the income distribution. But if life has been good for the top 1%, life has been super awesome for the top 0.01%. Now, the reason this matters in terms of the marketplace of ideas is not so much the effects on society, but rather essentially we now have a new class of plutocrats that essentially has more money than they know what to do with, and it turns out that what they want to do is go back to college. They are to have a genuine interest in promoting, you know, greater degrees of intellectual discourse. And this is true whether we're talking about Mark Zuckerberg, or whether we're talking about Bill Gates, or whether we're talking about the Koch brothers. Except it turns out they don't actually go back to college. What they wind up doing is creating their own intellectual salons, or attending other intellectual salons, like the Davos, you know, World Economic Forum, or PopTech, or South by Southwest, or the Milken Global Conference, or a whole variety of these kinds of conference circuits. Now, this in and of itself is not a bad thing. I think, on the whole, it's genuinely good that billionaires have an interest in ideas, and certainly this doesn't make them any different from, let's say, predecessors like Andrew Carnegie or John Rockefeller. The difference is that these people are still alive. And because they're still alive, they do want to use their money to potentially try to influence the marketplace of ideas, but they function in some ways like the term is philanthrocapitalists, which is essentially they want a return on their nonprofit investment. They want a return on their intellectual investment. They want to make sure that if they do this, it has impact. And it's tough to measure impact when we're talking about the marketplace of ideas. I mean, we can measure the degree to which things are mentioned, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people agree with it or not, or that people have truly internalized the beliefs. And this can potentially be a problem. It's also potentially a problem because essentially you can argue that the top 0.01%, that billionaires might have very strong disagreements on things like social policy or even potentially economic policy. But by hanging around with each other and by potentially going to these conferences, they wind up sharing a similar kind of worldview, which is they, generally speaking, don't necessarily believe that much in the role of the state in terms of providing key public goods or providing key functions in terms of both domestic politics and in terms of foreign policy. And indeed, there is a danger to some extent that they might look at the world and look at international relations and look at sort of traditional diplomacy and essentially think of it as a faulty piece of code that either needs to be bypassed or hacked. Now, potentially, and so as a result, you wind up with sort of nonprofits that essentially completely bypass the state. And there are times where that might actually be correct, but there are also times where you simply cannot ignore the role of the American government in terms of doing things like running foreign policy. So who are the winners and losers as a result of this kind of new ideas industry? The losers are sort of the traditional sources of authority. So as I said before, universities potentially, you know, face some difficulties. On the one hand, the sort of expansion of this entire marketplace does lead to a demand for more intellectuals, but it also shifts the demand from public intellectuals to thought leaders. And the simple fact is, and I can say this being a university professor, most university professors are public intellectuals. I mean, we hedge ourselves to within an inch of our lives when we're talking to the public, because that's what we do when we do our scholarly work. But most members of the public don't want to hear us hedging. They want to hear people making, you know, very powerful affirmative statements, you know, saying this is true, even if we're not necessarily certain about this. The other problem is that universities run afoul of at least two of the trends that I talked about causing a shift to thought leaders, which is university professors are actually shifting way further to the left. So this is a chart from the UCLA's Higher Education Research Institute that basically surveys professors and asks them whether they self-identify as being on the left or liberal, moderate, or being conservative. And as you can see from the data, basically, you know, in 1989, 1990, you had approximately two liberals on campus for every conservative. So there's no denying that the campuses were always further to the left than the American body politic, but it wasn't that much. We're now operating in a world where essentially you have six times as many liberals as you do conservatives in universities. And this ratio is even more concentrated if you exit, you know, let's say the hard sciences and talk about the social sciences. And the problem with this is that essentially is twofold. First, just because people in political science departments or economics departments are way to the left doesn't mean they do bad research. That would be like complaining that the military is further to the right and therefore we can't trust them. These are all professions. They operate according to professional codes and ethics. Peer-reviewed scholarship doesn't, you know, get accepted just because it promotes a liberal worldview. What it does do, however, is potentially alter the questions that, you know, scholars ask. And so as a result, I do think the conservative criticism of universities is a little more accurate here in saying, if conservatives are not on campus, then there might be certain questions that they don't ask because it makes liberals somewhat uncomfortable. And the other issue here is that essentially it creates an easy cheap shot, which is to say, if a group of professors produces an impeccable piece of research arguing we must do public policy X, and conservatives don't like it for whatever reason, conservatives can always say, well, that is a typical response from an out-of-touch elite liberal academic. And there's at least some degree of truth in that statement, even if the actual research is still accurate. And so as a result, it renders them politically vulnerable. The second group of losers are the sort of traditional nonprofit think tanks. And here I'm talking about the things like the Council on Foreign Relations, or the Brookings Institution, or the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or what have you. I should go back. There was one other evidence of this. So I did survey elite sort of intellectuals and policymakers about their attitudes about social science, basically asking them if they had more or less confidence in it over the last 10 years. So this is the chart showing all of the responses I got. And, you know, if you lump together more confidence and about the same, you have a majority of people that have pretty strong faith in the research from social science. But this is what the data looks like if you look at people who, you know, self-identified as either conservative or libertarian, which is they are much more skeptical of academic research than other forms of intellectuals. With regard to think tanks, one of the things that has happened over the last 10 years or so is that essentially the 2008 financial crisis has left think tanks badly overexposed. In the previous 7 years, between 9/11 and 2008, a lot of think tanks suddenly started building, you know, gaudy new headquarters in Washington. They got a lot of research funding from the federal government. Their endowments were swelling because the stock market was booming and so forth. Then when the crash happened, federal funding dried up and traditional sort of foundation support dried up. So as a result, these think tanks wound up trying to look for new sources of income. In some cases, it was Silicon Valley. In other cases, it was sort of traditional multinational corporations. In other cases, it was foreign governments. And the problem is that this has left think tanks being exposed to essentially accusations of pay for play, in which, you know, there's actually a memo from the government of Norway arguing that we should totally fund, you know, think tanks in Washington because that's how we can access key policymakers. And accusations of conflict of interest are extremely difficult to combat for nonprofit think tanks. And in terms of political science as opposed to economics, this is another issue. Essentially, one of the arguments I make in the book is that economics has done really well in this new marketplace, whereas my traditional discipline, political science, is not. And there's a variety of reasons for this, but the biggest one I would argue is that economists are simultaneously more to the right than political scientists are. If you poll economists, they much more, you know, they're much more close to the political center. And also, economists have a worldview that sells extremely well to plutocrats, which is to say the logic of the invisible hand, the logic of if you, you know, just engage in the pursuit of self-interest, all of society benefits, is a message that billionaires like to hear. Political scientists, on the other hand, we're just the skunks at the party. We like to tell people that essentially there are structural factors that really matter, that individual agency is not necessarily that important. And if you're really, really rich, this is partially due to your effort, but it might be partially due to the fact that you were born on third base. And that is something that surprisingly a lot of rich people don't like to hear. So they won't listen to political scientists necessarily, but they certainly will listen to economists. All right, in terms of the winners, there are three categories. The first is the private sector supplier of ideas, and I'll get to that in a little bit. The second are sort of the more partisan think tanks. And Beyonce always wins. Let's just be honest about that. That doesn't but the reason I have Beyonce there is basically I'm talking about intellectual superstars. So in terms of the McKinseys of the world, what you're increasingly seeing is the rise of for-profit think tanks. Whether we're talking about the McKinsey Global Institute or Goldman Sachs Research Institute or Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts, which actually hired David Petraeus to head their own in-house think tank, or political risk consulting like the Eurasia Group. These kinds of groups genuinely produce interesting research. I've consumed a lot of their work, and I don't mean to diminish it, but there are two potential problems with it. The first is that because these are for-profit industries, they very often don't make their data available to people. Because very often, if McKinsey Global Institute is producing a report, the report is based in no small part on the proprietary work they have done by consulting for various corporations. So they can legitimately explain, we can't make this data available. Which is fine, but it makes it hard for me as an outsider to necessarily take their arguments, you know, on faith, or it requires me to take their arguments on faith. I can't stress test their own analyses. And this is certainly true as well, even within the confines of Silicon Valley, when Facebook does an analysis on social media, for example, or something like that. The second problem with this is that, weirdly, even though for-profit companies obviously are generally producing this research with the idea of attracting and drawing people in to hire their services, weirdly, that is seen as less hypocritical than nonprofit think tanks doing research. Because at least the for-profit folks like McKinsey are saying, look, we're out to make a buck. And weirdly enough, in the marketplace of ideas, that is somehow seen as refreshing. The second group of winners are the more partisan think tanks. And here, the Heritage Foundation is a good example on the right. The Center for American Progress is an example on the left. And the reason is that you increasingly have people either in the form of Sheldon Adelson on the right or let's say Tom Steyer on the left that are perfectly willing to fund partisan think tanks but actually don't want these think tanks to necessarily cooperate with people on the other side to actually produce, let's say, cross-cutting policy issues like prison reform or promoting human rights in American foreign policy. And then in terms of superstars, we can talk about the fact that essentially one of the things that has happened now, even in the marketplace for foreign policy ideas, is that it increasingly resembles the marketplace for either entertainment or sports, which is essentially the people at the very top tier wind up commanding a disproportionate share of the total revenue from that sector. And so as a result, you have people like Fareed Zakaria, who is sort of a traditional public intellectual, and Niall Ferguson, who's just down the road, and I would argue is a traditional thought leader, commanding anywhere between mid five figures to low six figures for speaking fees, which they can do once or twice a month. Now, again, for many of you potentially, and certainly for many of the people in this headquarters, the idea of potentially making $1 million by just giving speeches for a year might not seem like that much money. To someone like me, who is getting a PhD, you know, who got a PhD in political science and never imagined that that would ever be within the realm of possibility, this does affect what you do somewhat. And as a result, if you can make it to that top tier, if you can make it to that sort of top speaking level, you wind up actually becoming a superstar. But the other problem is that you wind up essentially becoming a brand rather than an individual thinker. Essentially, you are no longer asked to just write a column for the Washington Post, which Fareed Zakaria does. You have to write a column. You have to produce a book. You have to do a TV show. You have to do a TV documentary based on the book you wrote, which, by the way, Niall Ferguson has done six times. All of these things are really good, but essentially, you are asking intellectuals to do the one thing that intellectuals are really, really bad at, which is manage themselves. And inevitably, if you wind up being put in this situation, corners don't necessarily get cut, but they get rounded a little bit. So in the case of Fareed Zakaria, he is running into trouble in terms of plagiarism scandals because it turns out that approximately 15 of his columns cribbed, you know, language from other things that he had basically cut and paste. Or in the case of Niall Ferguson, making claims in his columns he just turned out to be wildly factually inaccurate. And the problem is that the sort of intellectuals in the top tier wind up making ever more of these mistakes. And as a result, the sort of top-tier intellectuals, particularly thought leaders, wind up essentially being treated a lot like indie rock bands, which is everyone likes their early work, you know, their early authentic work back when they were sort of at the low level, you know, when it just used to be about the ideas, man. But then once they actually get to a, you know, degree of celebrity, they wind up producing things that invite massive amounts of criticism. And the result is, therefore, a world in which the marketplace of ideas now functions in some ways like financial markets, which is to say they're asset bubbles. They're ideas that gain a fair amount of intellectual cachet that might actually have some the germs of a really good argument, but as a result wind up getting applied more and more to sectors that they never should have been applied to. And one example of this is the logic of disruptive innovation, which is certainly embraced within Silicon Valley, and I think you could argue potentially even applies to Silicon Valley, but does not apply to things like foreign policy or higher education or other sectors of the economy, which Clayton Christensen, who came up with this idea, claimed that it actually did. And so as a result, these ideas expand far more than they used to because thought leaders have more power than they used to, and it takes more effort by public intellectuals to beat it back. The other effect of this on particularly successful intellectuals is that because they will potentially produce less quality work once they get up to the top tier, and because they are commanding a disproportionate share of the benefits, they essentially become targets with huge X's on their backs. Which means the effect of this on those intellectuals is that they are going to be more and more likely to tune out criticism. Because to be fair, this criticism will often come in the form of trolling, that essentially, or takedowns. So as a result, you know, I've talked to Fareed Zakaria about this, and he says that about two-thirds of the criticism he gets because of columns that he writes for the Washington Post or because of his show on CNN is essentially racist in origin. You know, that accuse him of being like a member of ISIS or accuse him of some absurd thing. And he can legitimately and appropriately should dismiss that. The problem becomes is that if you do that, it's a slippery slope to start to dismiss almost all forms of criticism. Because you can dismiss those who criticize you as either trolls or partisan hacks or people who are not as, you know, well-read as you. And it becomes to the point where you just wind up going in your own cocoon and not being receptive to any kind of advice whatsoever. And the result is what I call the Dark Knight theory of the ideas industry, which is you either die in obscurity or you live long enough to see yourself become everything that you despise when you became a young intellectual. And there are degrees to which I feel like even, you know, I'm not at the Niall Ferguson or Fareed Zakaria level. I like to think of myself as sort of upper middle class in terms of the public intellectual world. And yet there are times where I look at myself and it's like, dude, what are you doing? And there, you know, I do get worried about it. So what is to be done? And I confess that here the problem is that the sort of trends that I'm talking about, which is the erosion of trust, rise of political polarization, increase in wealth inequality, are kind of macro trends that, you know, require major large-scale reforms. And whether or not they affect the marketplace of ideas or not is almost a subsidiary question. But given that those trends are going to persist, what can be done? One thing I would argue is that universities need to do a better job in terms of promoting not just individual academics, but also promoting their brands. So one of the things I did as being part of the Fletcher School was we took a Carnegie Corporation grant about trying to make better connections in terms of our research to policymakers. And we went out as a combined team. So it wasn't just me. It was me and like five other Fletcher School researchers. And while I know that sort of teamwork is more common in the hard sciences, in the social sciences, it's a little rarer. And the thing I was struck by doing this was the degree to which people in the US government or people in the European Union or even public audiences seem more impressed that we were all part of Fletcher rather than sort of our own individual, you know, names. And in some ways, for them, I think the whole was greater than the sum of the parts. The second thing that needs to be done is just patience, which is to say, I do think that one of the things that's been happening in the philanthropic world that has been unfortunate has been this obsession with impact. The notion that if you give money to university professors or think tanks, you want to see an immediate payoff as a result of that. And the truth is that very often in the marketplace of ideas, you need to have patience. You need to recognize that if you, you know, fund research, it's not always going to come immediately. And furthermore, even if you write a book that no one immediately listens to, it might actually potentially become more influential 3, 4, 5 years from now. And so that's not nothing. The middle one is more foundation support, essentially, for more traditional public intellectuals to learn how to better game the marketplace of ideas, how better to actually go in and make their own particular points. And then the last thing is self-restraint, which is, in some ways, intellectuals, you would argue, are potentially the one category of individual that presumably doesn't only care about money. That, you know, we do actually are supposed to care about the quality of our ideas. And so I would like to think that over time what might eventually happen is that even people like Fareed Zakaria or Niall Ferguson do care desperately what other intellectuals think of them. And so potentially being told, maybe you don't have to say yes to every speaking gig or say yes to every book contract, would potentially allow something in the way of more diversity at the top of the intellectual food chain. And with that, I'm happy to take your questions. Thank you very much.
You mentioned that you talked about disruption in higher education.
Yep.
How do you reconcile that with the cost of student debt, increasing cost of education going up?
I would say two things on that. The first is that while I don't deny the increase in student debt overall, a disturbingly large portion of that is not actually from what you would consider traditional universities. It's mostly coming from the private, you know, sort of for-profit university sector. And that's a real problem. But I would divorce, let's say, the University of Phoenix or some of these other, you know, for-profit universities from what you would think of traditionally as the sort of four-year colleges. If you actually take a look at the average debt load of people who go to those institutions, you know, I believe it's around 30,000, which is, I don't want to dismiss that entirely, but if you have a debt load of 30,000 after graduating, you know, for the BA, you are probably going to be able to get a job that can pay that off. So I think, you know, among other things, claims that there's a higher ed bubble have been by and large exaggerated. That said, I will say this, and this is going to be something where I'm actually going to be looking at this over the next couple of years, and I'll be curious. You can argue that one of the ways in which universities have been able to fund themselves over the last 10 years or so has been an increase in the number of foreign students studying in the United States. And that's been a definite increase. You know, there was a lull after 9/11, but basically over the last 10 years to 15 years, you've seen increases on the order of 5 to 6% a year. There is increasing evidence that that is coming to an end. Now, part of that was because the dollar has risen in value, so suddenly we're just more expensive, even, you know, regardless of tuition prices. But there is no denying the fact that Donald Trump as president has potentially cast something of a pall on foreign students potentially trying to apply to the United States. There was an interesting OECD paper called The War on Talent that talked about how essentially, or the global market for talent, that there are essentially four places where well-educated individuals go to get jobs: the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. It would be interesting to see over the next couple of years whether, because of Brexit and because of the Trump administration, you see, you know, sort of high levels of human capital flows decline into both the United States and the United Kingdom and increase to places like Canada and Australia. And if that happens, then it'll be interesting to see what happens in terms of the economics of higher education.
In terms of over the past 20, 30 years and the accessibility of information, how do you think that impacts the kind of scale
That's a great question. I think that's part of the source of it, which is if you are genuinely interested in something, you know, it used to be, well, you have to go to school in order to figure out how do I find out the information. You now literally can Google it, potentially. So that's, I think on the one hand, that's a good thing. It means that potentially people who are genuinely interested in ideas don't need a Stanford degree or a Harvard degree or any degree to be able to potentially read what they want to read. The problem with it is that essentially you are seeing increasingly a degree of cyber balkanization, in which if you whatever your sort of pre-existing intellectual worldview is, you are naturally going to be drawn to that quarter of the internet to get information that seems to be, you know, confirming it. And indeed, this is actually a case where potentially education doesn't necessarily play that much of a role. Indeed, well-educated people are often better at cocooning themselves than less well-educated people, because well-educated people can rationalize why they're cocooning in a way that less well-educated people can't. That said, I don't want to say that this is like an overwhelming phenomenon. Not everyone cocoons themselves. There's a reason why things like TED Talks are particularly popular. There's a reason why you see an ever-increasing number of platforms for people who can potentially try to make these kinds of arguments. I would argue there are a fair number of Americans that genuinely, you know, either don't have really strong ideological priors or are intellectually rigorous enough to recognize, look, I might be wrong, so what is the best contrary view? And in that sense, that's good for people like me, because it means we have a wider audience than we used to. You know, I remember being told once when I was first getting my PhD that if I wanted to influence, you know, policymakers, there were basically four places I could publish. You know, the op-ed page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and Foreign Affairs. That was what, like, policymakers read, and it didn't matter what the public cared about. That's obviously changed. And one of the benefits of that is that there are now different ways that you can potentially influence top policymakers. It's not just talking to them in a room. It's also if you make an argument that is seen as relatively popular, that attracts enough eyeballs to reading it, it generates more attention that way. And we're in a situation now where you can write something for Medium and it goes viral, you know, in a way that even if you write something for Foreign Affairs in the New York Times, it doesn't. So it's a mixed bag. Hopefully, as I said at the outset, there's a tendency when you write about this stuff to think, oh, God, things were so much better before. I don't want to make that argument. I don't think things are great, but I think they're just bad in a different way from the way they were before.
As a consumer of ideas, my strategy for avoiding getting cocooned or stuck in some place is to look for moderates. Look for moderates who I think are very intelligent And so Niall Ferguson is a good example for me. If I picked New York Times, I would pick David Brooks, for example. But I mean, does that seem like a reasonable approach?
No, you're stupid and you shouldn't do that. No, I'm sorry. But I would dispute. Let me put it this way. I would push back somewhat, which is to say, I don't want a world where all you're doing is listening to moderates. First of all, the word moderate doesn't necessarily, I can paint two different kinds of moderates that would have extremely different kinds of views. Part of the issue is that talking about the left-right political spectrum works in some ways, but it doesn't work in others. But the other thing is that very often someone, you know, working on the far right or even working on the far left does come up with a genuinely interesting idea that has to become, that you should be exposed to. So I got to spend 3 weeks in Bellagio, Italy, for example, and I'll explain why this story is coming up. At the Rockefeller Foundation, they have a villa in Bellagio, Italy. I highly recommend this for everyone. Everyone should spend 3 weeks in Bellagio. It's a great thing to do. But one of the things I did while I was there is that I decided not to use Twitter or social media as a general rule. The reason this matters is that for me, Twitter is kind of my news feed. And I follow a variety of people, intellectually pretty heterogeneous. And what I discovered over those 3 weeks was that, you know, essentially, rather than sort of having a fire alarm style of exposure to ideas where I would just have the feed and I would just get constantly bombarded with new ideas, I actually had to do actively searching. It was more police patrolling. I had to actually go look for things. And I was able to find the moderate centrist ideas that you know, I found potentially naturally appealing. What was more difficult was to find the more contrarian takes on both the left and the right, because that required me to go to sites where the wheat to chaff ratio was so low that I didn't want to read like 10 bad articles to find one good one. Whereas on the other hand, weirdly, social media let me, like, it meant that others would read those things and say, hey, this is good, you should check this out. And because I trusted that person, I would then read it. And it's not like I would always agree with it, but it was an interesting provocative argument. And so weirdly, I think by being off social media, I actually found myself lacking those kinds of contrarian takes, which are the ones that I value, because those are the ones that challenge my preconceived worldviews. And it doesn't mean they convince me, but at least it makes me have to figure out, what do I agree with? Why does this trouble me so much, and so forth? So I would say you don't want to just listen to people like Neil Ferguson or David Brooks. You want to read Paul Krugman, or you want to read, you know, Jacobin magazine. You're not always going to agree with it, and you probably will very rarely will, but you might get exposed to a different point of view.
Are there any public intellectuals right now that you admire for not succumbing to the sort of self-promotion, who are willing to be obscure?
Oh, wow, no one's asked me that. Actually, a guy that I genuinely admire is Francis Fukuyama, which might sound odd because everyone, you know, the one thing I'm sure you've heard if you say Francis Fukuyama is end of history, like, oh, well, that was totally wrong, and why should you listen to him? Fukuyama really, I think, in some ways could have become an even bigger superstar if he chose to. He could have, like, gone the TED Talk route or you know, gotten a column or so on and so forth. He is stuck instead to writing books. First of all, I would argue the End of History book, if you actually read it, is a much more nuanced discussion than the sort of caricature version of it. But the other thing is that he's really done some excellent work since then. And has really, you know, it's not that he's not like J.D. Salinger, like in Vermont, you know, not doing anything new or not engaging the public. He does. It's just that he does it in a very judicious way. And in some ways, I admire his self-control on that. I don't necessarily have that option. As I said, I'm not quite at that level. But he's definitely someone who I admire in terms of being able to do that. And I guess the other person I would admire would be Samantha Power. Not that I necessarily agree with her on everything, but she wound up, you know, she wrote a great book, The Problem from Hell, wound up being an advisor to the Obama campaign in 2008, and then eventually became the UN ambassador. The reason I admire her is first because she's extremely passionate about her ideas, but far more important than that, I did a very depressing survey of asking people who they thought the most influential intellectuals were in the foreign policy world. And of the top 25 names, there was one woman. And it was her. And that was just really depressing. Because I know a fair number of really smart women who are, you know, have serious impact. But the fact that that was the answer, I found profoundly disturbing. And so one of the other ways, which I didn't talk about, that I do think you can improve the marketplace of ideas is by promoting a greater degree of diversity. Not necessarily because women are automatically going to have better ideas than men or even different ideas from men. But it does break up that sort of superstar concentration that I don't think is good for the marketplace of ideas.
All right. Well, I think that's it for questions. Thank you, everyone, for coming. And let's give a hand to Mr. Dreser one last time.
Thank you very much.